2312 and 2180. I think we have some presenters this morning, so let's start with 2312.
Mr. Chair, if I may, before we get started, I wanted to point out one thing you have in your packet, which is some background information from Governing Magazine. It has a review of Oregon's revenue system and kind of gives you a background. Some of the things, most of the things you've seen and are aware of, but it kind of gives you a perspective from an outside organization. And they actually have all 50 states in the new issue. And I did copy on the back. To make efficient use of our resources, I copied on the back the Washington summary. So it's kind of an interesting contrast between the two. So that's just for your general information and general background.
Thank you.
And then, Mr. Chair, I'll have Dick come up and start off with House Bill 2312.
Okay.
Do they already have anything? No.
Dick, why don't you come on up here?
Mr. Chair, Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. House Bill 2312 deals with essentially the qualifying statute for the Master Settlement Agreement, and you have also among the materials given to you this morning a research brief that we did during the interim, research brief number 9-02, the Master Settlement Agreement, and that just gives you some background information about the Master Settlement Agreement. What House Bill 2312 does is to simply make it clear that some of the definitions in the qualifying statute apply to the qualifying statute and not ambiguous, essentially, as to whether or not they apply elsewhere in the ORS. Of significance particularly there, other than just the idea that the statute should be clear when they make definitions as to what those definitions apply to. One of the definitions in the bill is the definition of a cigarette. And we have a cigarette elsewhere defined in Chapter 323 with a slightly different definition. In particular, and I can't find my copy of the bill, here it is. On line 26, paragraph B, I guess it is, a cigarette, the term includes roll-your-own tobacco. That is not included in the Chapter 323 definition, so they are different. And so it's somewhat important to make it clear that the definition here applies to the qualifying statute, and that's the purpose of this bill. And I think what we have two things scheduled, essentially, for the committee. We have representatives from Treasury here to give some background, essentially, on what's going on with respect to the Master Settlement Revenues, and Joan Robinson here from Council to discuss why they want this particular bill.
Okay. We'll take the presentation. Good morning. You can both come up and get us started.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff for the State Treasurer.
And I'm Chuck Smith, Director of Debt Management for the State Treasury.
And our presentation today isn't specific to this bill. It relates to it to an aspect of it, in that we're giving you an update on the Master Settlement Asset Corporation and the tobacco securitization that was approved during the fifth special session. And you should have before you enrolled House Bill 4073 from the fifth special session. That is the bill that created the MSA Corp, as we use for its handle. And later in this meeting today, you will, I believe, be doing a bill introduction on an LC that makes some technical changes to that enrolled bill. As you know, there was this is a fairly complex transaction, and there, on further reflection, there are some technical adjustments to be made to that bill. So we expect to see that bill returning to the committee next week, and we will testify on it substantively at that time. But before you is House Bill 4073 that created the Master Settlement Asset Corporation, and there's also a sheet you have that just gives a bit of an update. We appeared before this committee, or the interim committee, at the end of November, and I'll just briefly go through it. The MSA Corp was created as a mechanism to essentially do tobacco settlement revenue bonds. The way that the industry has developed on those type of asset sales is to create a semi-public corporation. And this bill then created that corporation for Oregon in order to securitize $150 million in proceeds. There's an additional sheet that Chuck will address here that breaks down the costs of that. Just as a summary, this act creates a board of directors, a corporation board of directors, three members. The state treasurer is the board chair and executive director, and there are two public members. The treasurer has appointed those, and the corporation had its first meeting January 9th. It meets again next week. The state treasury, as we do on many of the other state bond sales, is providing the staffing functions for the corporation, and DOJ is the providing counsel. Right now, we are trying to get our professionals lined up in order to assist us in this. We have RFPs that have gone out or we're preparing to go out. For a number of these that you see listed here in front of you, we have selected already bond counsel. We have a local bond counsel in Portland and also a national. This was a national RFP, and this is a pretty specific area, and there are a number of firms that are essentially specializing in this. And so we've selected a national bond counsel, and there's a co-bond counsel that is a local one, Preston Gates in Portland, and they have also were part of the recent Washington tobacco securitization. We've also selected the financial advisor out of Portland as well. The corporation, as you see, is using the underwriting team that DAS has already lined up to market the securities, and we're anticipating or have set a sale date as March 17th. Chuck can go over here with you just how this works and how the costs are figured. As I'm sure you've heard if you weren't on this committee before, that this is an unusual structuring in that it's on a very short time frame. We're doing what's called a turbo structure, where the repayment is actually as short as can be, and it's approximately 4 years right now. That's different than just about any other state or local government that's done securitization deals in the nation. Many of them are going out for 20, 30 years. And I'll let Chuck address the structure.
Okay, thanks, Kate. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to be referring to this little table here. Essentially, this sort of outlines some of the estimates that we've made respecting the $150 million financing for deposits for the state's school fund. We start out with our anticipated ratings. Obviously, we don't have the ratings yet in hand because we haven't produced all the documents and got that to the rating agencies. That will come shortly. We're anticipating that about 77% of the MSA payments will be used to repay these bonds. We're issuing bonds in about $200 million in par value. That's going to produce enough for $150 million in proceeds for the deposit to the school fund. Plus, it produces other monies that are used, for instance, in a reserve fund, which will be used to make the last payments on the bonds, some capitalized interest, in order to issue the bonds this year and not interfere with this biennium's MSA payments for other budgetary purposes. We have cost of issuance and some rounding there on the original issue premium. The key factor on this bond, really outside of its underlying revenue stream, which is tobacco payments that the state is expected to receive through the Master Settlement Agreement, is that, as Kate just mentioned, unlike most other states, the legislature chose to borrow this money over a very short period of time, especially a very short period of time when you take a look at tobacco bonds in other states. We expect a final maturity payment in 2007, which would be 4 years. We have a final rated maturity, which is sort of a legal maturity date of 5 years. But we expect that utilizing about 77% of the MSA payments, these bonds would be able to be fully retired inside of a four-year basis. During this period, we're going to be looking at average MSA revenues of about $74 million. We're looking at average debt service of about $56 million. And under a little heading there called remaining revenues, we put down the estimated revenues that would be remaining after debt service payments. In 2003, those are the full revenues that the state will receive, and there will be no debt service payment made. In 2004, 5, and 6, these bonds have been structured so that the legislative intent to use MSA payments for the Oregon Health Science University bonds, which have been previously issued for a grant for their biotech endeavors at the Oregon Health Science University, there's been earmarking done of about $17 million to pay for those bonds. Those were general obligation bonds that were voted on by the people here last year for Oregon Health Science University. So that earmarking has been sort of set aside so that it's available to make debt service on those. And you can see, once again, beginning in 2007, as the bonds pay off, MSA payments that flow to the state's general fund increase. And in 2008, the full MSA payment would be expected to flow to the general fund at that time for use as the legislature saw fit. So that's sort of a rundown of some of the numbers here.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Representative Williams.
Thank you. I just am interested in the remaining revenues and the stream that you projected there. Does that assume a standard payment into the settlement agreement from the tobacco companies without variation, or have you factored some amount of slippage potentially in that payment over the course of those years into your numbers?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, we're going to let Dick Yates answer that question.
Good morning, Dick. We got this model. It's linear regression.
We're familiar with the model.
If you look at the research report, there is sort of in the agreement numbers which are nationally annual payments to be made, but those payments and they go into an national escrow account, and Oregon gets about 1.5% of those revenues. Those payments are subject to a number of adjustments. The most important one from our standpoint is the volume adjustment, which says that basically if the volume of cigarettes sold by the major tobacco companies go down, there is an adjustment to those payments. And I've made an attempt to estimate that, and we also have a WEFA estimate, Wharton School of Economics, of what those revenues will be. And fortunately for me, at least, the two estimates are pretty close. But it is, you know, it's an estimate. It's not certain. Mm-hmm. So you do have two things here. One, the final rated maturity of 2008 would allow some slippage there in terms of when the bonds are paid off if the 77% turns out to be less than we've estimated. But I guess that's about all I have to say is that we've tried to make estimates.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I could, that's really was my concern. So long as somebody at least has tried to, we haven't looked at it statically. We've tried to factor in the possibility of some slippage into the numbers. That makes me more comfortable with where we're headed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, if I might add to, and in the LC draft that you'll be introducing as a committee bill later in the meeting today, too, it does address one other possible aspect, which would be there has been some speculation that because of Oregon's punitive damages law and also some pending litigation regarding tobacco companies with private individuals in Oregon, that there may be some disruption as they try to sort that out between tobacco companies and the state to the MSA stream. This LC, which will be coming in today, and which we still have a couple of tiny technical amendments yet to addresses these bonds in that protecting the MSA stream or the backing for these bonds regardless too. So it provides some security for the market.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. Any other questions?
If I may, Chuck, has the full $200 million for OHSU been authorized? Is that or issued?
No, as a matter of fact, about the first, I think about $93 million has been issued. The second and final issuance would take place after this legislative session in late summer.
Thanks.
And, Mr. Chair, when the LC draft becomes a bill and returns to this committee, we'll come back and testify on that then.
We'll welcome you back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on 2312. And the next one that we... go ahead.
I guess I wanted Joan Robinson to come.
Oh, I'm sorry. We do have... I apologize. I'll revoke that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Joan Robinson from Legislative Council. And I just want to explain the bill. We don't take positions on legislation. The master's, as Dick said, this is the deals with the definitions for what's called the qualifying statute for the master settlement agreement, and the only issue is whether this constitutes, whether this particular amendment specifying what the definitions apply to constitutes an amendment, a substantive amendment to the qualifying statute, and because the state is prohibited, states are prohibited from doing that. I have spoken with Pete Shepard at Department of Justice about that, and he does not believe that it is a substantive amendment. I do not believe it is a substantive amendment. It is simply making it clear what the definitions apply to. Pete has been in touch with people at the National Association of Attorneys General. I don't know whether they call themselves NAGs or not. And he doesn't think there will be a problem. But I just wanted to alert you that if there were ever to be a problem with this bill, that's what the problem would be. And it seems to me that would be exalting form over substance. But anyway, so it's just a clean up the statutes bill. Happy to answer any questions.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So all this bill really does is to say, these definitions apply to the part we intended them to apply to,
exactly.
And not to something else.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's just good drafting practice when you do definitions to say what they apply to. And I think probably what happened when this statute was originally drafted is there was so much pressure to get every word identical to what every other state who's a participant in the agreement was doing, and people were not thinking of the details of good drafting practice, and it just slipped away, I think. But yes, that's all it does. Nothing of substance.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair. Mr.
Representative Flora.
Thank you. I'm just trying to make sure I fully understand this. The definition of cigarette includes roll your own tobacco. So if the tobacco is in a package but doesn't contain the little thing of papers that you get in the back of the package, is that not roll your own tobacco? It seemed a little bit vague.
I've never bought a package of roll your own tobacco, so I can't answer. I don't know.
I haven't either, but I've seen them.
I don't even know they came with papers in the back of them.
They do.
Packages
of Bugler have a little pack of papers in the back.
I'm sorry, I can't answer the question. Okay. If you want me to, I'll try to find out the answer, although it might not be
It's not that important. I'm just trying to clear a little bit of vagary in the back of my mind. So pipe tobacco wouldn't be roll your own tobacco.
I don't believe that pipe tobacco is part of the settlement. Is that, do you know?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question either as to whether pipe tobacco is a part of the settlement or not, but as far as Oregon is concerned, you have a distinction between cigarettes and other tobacco products. Now, both are subject to tax, but they're figured on a different basis. So if tobacco is basically not somehow seen as a cigarette or as sold for the purpose of making cigarettes, it's still subject to tax as another tobacco product. And that's probably made, you know, on a product-by-product basis. I don't know if there's, as you can see, these definitions are kind of a little bit loose where, you know, one might think the stated purpose is to roll a cigarette or something like that.
I didn't know it could be so difficult to describe what a cigarette is.
Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is expounding on the obvious, but my understanding of these definitions, and correct me if I misstated it, have a set of statutes which really put into effect the Master Settlement Agreement of 1998. And that's all they're for. And that's the reason why we have this amendment today, to make certain that these screwy definitions only apply to that section of the law.
Correct.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Additional? Thank you very much. Additional? Anyone else? Additional testimony? Now I can close it.
Yes.
Okay, now we'll close 2312. And we have another House Bill 2180 coming before us this morning. And there is has been determined potential revenue impact, so it's been assigned here. We have two folks that have signed up to we're going to have some background with the state lands.
Thank you.
Show this together. Okay.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Ann Hannes. I'm the director of the Division of State Lands. And I'm going to give a presentation on the Common School Fund, a little bit of background, including historical background, how it works, and what makes up the Common School Fund. The Common School Fund is a permanent trust fund created in the Constitution and at statehood to benefit current and future generations of public school children from grade K to 12. The trustees of the Common School Fund under the Constitution is the land board, and the land board consists of the governor, the secretary of state, and the treasurer. And the Division of State Lands acts as the administrative arm of the land board. According to the Oregon Constitution, the land board manages these lands, and this is directly from the Constitution, with the object of obtaining the greatest benefit for the people of this state, consistent with the conservation of this resource under sound techniques of land management. The Common School Fund asset portfolio consists of real estate property, and you'll see at the back of your packet there's a map that shows different land ownerships, but it also shows where we have lands that we own under the Common School Fund The largest chunks are the Elliott State Forest and the rangelands, but I'll be talking a little bit more about that as the presentation goes on. So there's the forest, range, and agricultural lands, but also submerged and submersible lands, that is the bed and the banks of rivers, as well as tidally influenced areas, and 3 miles out of the territorial sea, and the Division of State Lands building that's located in the northern part of the Capitol Mall. The Common School Fund itself amounts to $665 million as of the end of December, and that consists of three different sources: constitutional revenue, statutory revenue, and unclaimed property that's held in trust. Now, this next picture is a depiction of the flows of revenue coming into the Common School Fund. And it's important to keep in mind that each of those different flows into the Common School Fund have their own set of legal requirements about how they be managed and restrictions associated with them. So the constitutional revenue up in the upper left-hand corner is from the original land grant at statehood. Statutory revenue has been designated by the legislature, such as the submerged and submersible land revenues that are generated there. And then also the third part is the unclaimed property. This also shows the flow out of the Common School Fund corpus or principal itself, and out of that comes the earnings, and it's the earnings that are distributed to schools. The Common School Fund distribution, the land board sets the distribution policy, and those earnings are distributed twice yearly to public schools through the county treasurers. And in recent years, we've seen fairly wide swings in the distributions because of the stock market gyrations. Now, kind of going back over the history of the Common School Fund, it's a pretty interesting part of Oregon's history as well as our nation's history. Beginning with the state of Ohio at a time in our country's history when we were land rich and cash poor, the founding fathers were looking for ways in which to endow the schools and also to provide an incentive for the pioneers going west so that there would be a source of funding for schools. So they set aside two sections out of every township, that's 2 square miles out of every township, for schools. This idea dated back actually to King Henry VIII when he confiscated school lands from the church, and it was the church that provided the schooling, and so he set aside a portion of those lands for the benefit of schools, and our founding fathers then took a cue from what Henry VIII did. That represented, at the time that we received that two sections out of every township, roughly 6% of the total land base, or about 3.4 million acres. And these lands became known as school trust lands. Now, during about the first 50 or 60 years of our statehood, from 1859 on, those lands were sold quickly into private ownership. I think there was a strong belief that lands would yield more through property taxes and other economic benefits if left in public ownership, and it was also a way to provide some funding that was needed immediately at the time for schools. However, there's a black mark on Oregon's history in that a large portion of those lands were lost through fraudulent means by swindlers and land speculators. At the time, surveying, land records, and security measures were incomplete or non-existent, and unfortunately, corruption was extensive at the time. As you got into the early, late 1800s, public sentiment started to shift over concern over the loss and the kind of management that was occurring on the lands. In fact, there were state investigations that occurred in 1872, 1878, and 1896 that highlighted that corruption, but there weren't any major changes that were made. But then in 1902, the federal government investigated the land frauds, and that land fraud investigations and trials, the land fraud trials as they were called, made national news as well as state, major state attention, and that continued until 1913. There were actually 21 state and federal officials that ended up being prosecuted and charged and imprisoned, including at the time our U.S. senator and some legislators and land commissioner. Glad I wasn't there at the time. But
and thankfully none of us were.
In fact, there's, if you ever want to see at the State Library, there's a book that was written at the time by one of the individuals that was jailed, Stephen Pewter, called Looters of the Public Domain. It's a real rare copy. It's hard to find, but it is in the State Library that goes into all the sordid history about what happened at the time. Anyway, from that time on, it marked a change in how we viewed common school fund lands. In fact, it also set a major realignment in terms of how other states viewed the common school fund lands, and many states from there on try to conserve their lands and use them for schools. The state resources that we now have are 630,000 acres of rangeland and agricultural land, primarily in eastern Oregon is the rangeland and agricultural land, 133,000 acres of forest land. That's the largest chunk of that, as I said, is the Elliott State Forest. However, we do have some scattered tracts in other areas of the state. And then 575 acres of industrial and other purposes land.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. A question regarding the 133,000 acres of forest land. How much of that is closed to harvest? Do you have any numbers on that?
Vice Chair Scott, Representative Farr, I don't have the exact numbers on that. There's a state forest plan, the Elliott State Forest Plan, that guides that. Mm-hmm. It, for the most part, is a working forest that is our largest source of revenue for the Common School Fund, mm-hmm. generating about $40 million over the biennium.
Is any of the Tillamook State Forest included in that?
There are small tracts within the Tillamook State Forest. Most of the Tillamook State Forest is dedicated for county trust land benefit, but there are a few common school fund lands scattered in there.
I'd be very interested to hear how many acres are indeed, or what percentage of the acreage is indeed closed to harvest.
I can have someone from the Department of Forestry contact you and provide you that information.
Please. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other resources that benefit the Common School Fund include 800,000 acres under the territorial seas within 3 miles of the shore. That's why the Division of State Lands and the Land Board were involved with the new CARISA most recently, because it was basically sitting on our land. Submerged and submersible lands under the state navigable waterways. So, for example, if you go up into the Portland area and you see houseboats on the Willamette River and docks and wharfs, those are ones in which we collect lease and payments from that benefit the Common School Fund. And then also estuary tide lands. We also manage mineral rights on approximately 3 million acres of DSL land and other state-owned land. We have permit fees from the removal fill program, for example, leases and civil penalties that go into the Common School Fund. Receipts from unclaimed property go in there, as well as the other area that we manage are estates with no wills and heirs. In fact, the estate portion is considered constitutional revenue. And then South Slough National Estuary and Reserve, which is located near Coos Bay. This next map is an illustration of all the different types of activities we're engaged in efforts to raise money for the Common School Fund, from industrial port leases, houseboats, minerals, the Elliott State Forest, easements, rangeland, communication towers, and agricultural land. So it's a wide variety of activities that we're involved with. Turning to unclaimed property, under Oregon's Unclaimed Property Act, Oregon is the trust owner of abandoned funds when rightful owners cannot be found. We search for those owners, but in the meantime, that money is held in perpetuity in the state, in the Common School Fund, in which we benefit from that, our school kids benefit from that by the earnings that are generated from that. But in the meantime, I'd suggest it's always interesting to go check on the website to see, if you have some money. Most recently, my husband was delighted to find that he had an expense check from an old job he didn't know about. Mm. But, in fact, there was a Dateline show that occurred about, I think, in the last year that shut down the entire state websites because of the inflow of people checking our our site to see if they had money. But and it comes from a whole variety of sources, such as dormant bank accounts, safety deposit box contents that are dormant, payroll checks of which they can't find the employee. In terms of estate administration, this is for individuals that die without a will or heirs. We search for those heirs. We inventory. We act as executor for those wills. If after 10 years, however, we cannot find the heirs, then those assets become part of the common school fund. For the South Slough Reserve, this is 4,800 acres of open water and tidelands. It's managed for research, education on estuary systems and restoration. We get it's a tourism attraction there, but also it's a major educational opportunity where 4,000 students visit it and are engaged in activities there each year. In terms of wetlands and removal and fill, we regulate removal, fill, and waterways and wetlands. Permit fees and fines help offset the costs. There is, I should note, a fee bill on that to increase fees for the next biennium in order to cover a larger share of the costs. Some of the basic land board principles are to, one, protect and expand distributions to schools as the long-term goal, to try to grow the principal as fast as practical, and to adjust major policies based on careful study and review of the alternatives. One of the trust principles that the land board must consider is the trust principle of intergenerational equity and distributions. Since the trust fund is considered a permanent fund, we have to look at how it benefits current day students as well as future generations of students, and to try to be equitable about that. In terms of the common school fund distribution, all revenues that are earned from DSL activities are deposited into the common school fund. The state treasurer and the Oregon Investment Council invest the fund. The values have ranged somewhere between $600 to $800 million, again, depending on market conditions. And as of December 31st, it was $665 million. As I mentioned, the land board establishes the distribution policy. It's a sliding scale policy that depends on the year-to-year changes in the common school fund fair market value. So we look at as of the end of December 31st to the next year in December 31st. We try to do a minimum 2% distribution regardless of the change in the value, and unfortunately in the last couple of years we've had losses due to the stock market. However, I have to underscore, provided the earnings are adequate to meet that 2% distribution. The distribution formula is one that is a sliding scale. So if the common school fund grows 5% or less, then we would distribute the minimum 2%, and we'd retain the remainder for inflation protection. If the common school fund grows between 5 to 11%, we'd use a formula to calculate the split between distribution and the retention for growth. And if it grows more than 11%, we'd make the maximum distribution of 5%. So there's a it doesn't show very well on this PowerPoint, but there is in the back of your packet a bar chart that shows what the growth of the fund would be, and then along this side here, what we would then distribute as a percentage of the fund. So it illustrates that sliding scale distribution.
Let me make that simple.
The common school fund earnings are sent to kindergarten through 12 public schools every 6 months at the end of June and December. They're sent to the counties based on a population of ages 4 to 20 for allocation to those schools. And the county treasurer splits the funds according to the district average daily membership according to the prior fiscal years. And those distributions have fluctuated between $9 million and $41 million. beginning in the 1980s, there were some important changes that were made to the fund that resulted in it growing especially fast, and it really was the envy of many of the western states. Changes to the Oregon law and investment policies boosted those earnings. In 1988, there was a constitutional amendment that allowed for investment of the common school fund in the stock market, subject to an investment cap of 50% of the fund principal at purchase cost. In 1997, the legislature increased the cap, and there was, and that at the time proved very timely, and quadrupled the fund due to the growth in the stock market and growth in revenues generated from land management. This shows how the Common School Fund has grown over over the years since 1982 to the present time. Our investment mix now is 68% in equities or stocks, 30% in bonds, and 2% in cash and short-term investments. So where does the money come from? It comes from all the resources and related income from trust lands that benefit the Common School Fund. This includes timber sales and grazing leases, land sales and easements, leases of submerged and submersible lands, permit fees and fines, estates with no will or heirs, and unclaimed property fund and proceeds. Approximately $49 million in revenues per biennium are generated from lands and permit fees, and approximately $20 million in unclaimed properties is deposited into the Common School Fund. Our expenditures are about $14.6 million. And the Oregon Department of Forestry, which is the agency that we contract with to manage the forest lands, is about $11 million. And that's paid out of the Common School Fund. During the 2001-03 budget period, we saw declines in the stock market and drops in interest rates. And regular distributions were $15.1 million in 2002. Now, there was a supplemental one-time distribution that the third special session of the legislature made, and that was using the $17.7 million all of the statutory revenues accumulated over 50 years. That was sent out in a special distribution this past December to the schools. This shows the distributions that have been made over time since 1990 to the current day, with the bar there in a darker blue showing the $17.7 million distribution that was sent out. And then in the next two fiscal years, we're expecting to send out $13 million and then $21.6 million. And you can see the large spikes up in 2000 and 2001, and that represents a time when we were seeing large growth in the stock market. Hopefully we'll see that again sometime. Some of the current issues related to the Common School Fund are whether or not to change the land board distribution policy. One of the things that we're seeking to try to do is to both stabilize and increase distributions over time. And House Bill 2180 is one idea that we've been exploring as a way to try to stabilize those distributions. We're looking at ways to increase revenue into the Common School Fund by land management activities, and then also to try to protect Common School Fund assets and to manage them. We have a variety of issues such as trespass and ones that we need to protect our land management. We also have heard over the last year use of the Common School Fund to try to address short-term budget problems, and then, as I mentioned, trying to stabilize distributions. I'll go into House Bill 2180 a little bit more in my testimony on that. This is just one idea that we've had, along with several, of trying to stabilize the distributions. It would basically establish a reserve fund from earnings to provide a minimum distribution in lean years, and it would allow the sale of investment at a loss without penalizing distributions. some other common school fund related legislation that you may hear about. House Bill 2253 would restructure the removal fill fees. There hasn't been an increase since 1989, and the fees now cover about 15% of the program cost. Thus, we could increase the flow of to the common school fund by increasing the fees by having less more of the cost of that program covered. And then also it is restructured according to suggestions we heard from legislators last session. Other common school fund legislation include Senate Bill 216, which would clarify language for trust properties. It would allow us more opportunities in different ways to auction off estates and contents from unclaimed properties, such as what we see in trust and safety deposit boxes. So, for example, it would allow us to use eBay, where we couldn't do that right now for unclaimed properties. And Senate Bill 64 is one that would deal with issues related to estates with no heirs or wills. This is one where we've been calling the laughing heirs bill. I believe Judiciary Committee is going to be dealing with this bill. This is where it would have some limit on how far back you would go in searching for heirs. For example, just recently we had an estate that we lost that was over $1 million, and it went to an individual that was a distant relative that had never heard of that person. We're also having situations where you have somebody in these heir firms find somebody in, say, an Eastern European country where there's not very good records. And so we think it's one way in which it could boost the common school fund while at the same time really making sure you get it to the rightful heirs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. Question regarding the fees that are paid in the removal and fill. Who is the typical payee of those fees?
Vice Chair Scott, Representative Farr. It would be somebody that is getting a permit for doing a removal fill activity that would impact a wetland or a waterway. Mm-hmm. So it could range from, say, a developer that is putting in a development and it would impact a wetland and would have to and would pay a fee and need a permit for that type of activity.
Okay. And currently the fees are covering only 15% of the cost of administering the program?
That's correct. At the time when the program was established, the fees were set up to cover 40%. But over the years, since there has not been any change in the fees, and it's been over 12 years now since there's been any kind of fee increase, that's dwindled over time.
Okay. And I would guess that's a relatively small number of dollars anyway.
Vice Chair Scott, Representative Farr, I think you're talking about it's about $1 million.
A year.
The fee increase itself would be about, I think it's around 400,000.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, could I clarify that on the fee increase? For instance, in the city of Coos Bay, you have Front Street, which the state would own all of the land underneath that entire waterway right there in front for the 3 miles out. But that's a potential development area. So that would mean that anyone developing that land and using it, if they had to do any fill or removal, would be increased. Is that
Vice Chair Scott? Vice Chair Berger, the removal fill, there are two issues I hear you talking about. One is the filled land issue, and there's, of whether or not that's an ownership issue, and they would have to pay a lease to the Common School Fund for development of lands that are owned by the Common School Fund. That's one part. The second part is if they are doing an activity, and this is for the on a regulatory side, if they're doing an activity where they're moving more than 50 cubic yards of material, then they would need to get a permit for removal fill activities, as long as it would be in an area where it would be wetland or waterway impacts.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Representative.
You said that in the distribution of funds in recent years, it's gone from $9 million to $41 million. That's quite a big difference. Can you explain that?
Vice Chair Scott, Vice Chair Berger, yes. The reason is because the distribution formula looked at the year-to-year change in the common school fund. And with our investments in stocks being at 68%, when the stock market went up so high and we had increases in the common school fund of 15 to 20%, during those years in the late 1990s, that then meant we were able to send out the maximum amount of the distribution to the schools, and hence we were able to send out amounts upwards of $40 to $50 million per year. But in the last couple years, when we've actually suffered losses in the common school fund, it that we sent out a minimum of 2%. Now, one of the things that we've heard from the Attorney General and advice that they've given us is that we can distribute no more than the earnings off of the fund. So we can't go into the principal of the common school fund, and nor can we recapture capital gains from several years ago to be able to distribute. So what we have to look at is what do we have in terms of earnings, that is from interest and dividends, and if there are any capital gains. And unfortunately, in the last several years, there have not been those capital gains to be able to distribute that mark those very high years.
Thank you.
So that ends my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Williams.
Thank you, Director House. I appreciate your presentation. I guess I'd be interested in revisiting with you just briefly some of the discussion that we had during the special sessions about use of particular portions of the Common School Fund. I noticed in the graphic that you had where it sort of showed the fund in the pictorial version, there was a little fence between the constitutional lands and the section that was the unclaimed property held in trust section. It was that a fence?
Yes, it's like a fence. Right.
Okay,
it was
right.
Meant to be.
And I guess, as you'll recall, in the special sessions, there was some fairly, what's the word I want to use? Heated isn't necessarily strong discussion amongst the legislature and our legislative council's office, and I believe the Attorney General's office and your department, about what portion of the principal of the Common School Fund that the legislature could potentially use for dealing with short-term budget issues. And one discussion of that was the use of some portion of the unclaimed property for a short-term usage. Has your position on that changed at all since the special session, or are the bills that you're proposing here directed to addressing that issue at all?
Vice Chair Scott, Representative Williams, our position has not changed on that. And you're correct, there were legal issues regarding the unclaimed property. One of the reasons why that is shown with a little fence there for the unclaimed property is that the state does not hold title to that unclaimed property. We hold it in trust in perpetuity, and thus I think legally the Attorney General has advised us that there are restrictions on being able to just use that without repaying it, and there are certain criteria that needs to be adhered to for a repayment if in fact that would be to be borrowed. But it is money that is being held in trust until the rightful owner or their heirs come forward. And part of that stems from model legislation that the 50 states have adopted, so that they, because different states may be holding unclaimed property that are really Oregon citizens and vice versa. So that legislation was passed by the different states in recognition of the special nature of unclaimed properties.
Mr. Chairman, one additional follow-up. Do you know what the value of the fund was in, say, February of 2002 as compared to its current value that you reflected?
Let me see if I could ask one of my staff if they happen to have that information.
Sure.
Maybe I can ask it this way. How much has the fund decreased in value over the last 2 years?
It's gone from this, I think around the summer of, and this is just off the top of my head, I think that from the summer of around 2000, it was upwards of 750 to 800 million when the stock market was at its highest. And so it's fluctuated in the last year between 600 to 700 million. And each month it fluctuates quite a bit depending on where the stock market is.
But it's fair to say that over the last 2 years, the value of the fund has probably lost in excess of $100 to $150 million. Is that right?
Vice Chair Scott, Representative Williams, that would be correct given from its peak of between 750 to 800, yes. And I think it reflects a lot of the investments that that we've seen in other funds.
The point I'm making, perhaps not terribly articulately, colleagues, is that had we taken some portion of the money out of the fund and used it for the purposes of education, the fund value would not necessarily. I mean, it's money we lost in the market anyway, you know. Obviously, like everybody else, we would have liked to have been able to time the market, but the fact of the matter is that we lost as much money as we potentially could have taken out of the fund by letting the money sit in the fund, and I think that's a real tragedy. And I'm not suggesting that it's the fault of the division, but I do think that we need to revisit the issue again this session of what our legal ability to use portions of that fund, particularly borrowing portions of the property money to address issues in our current fiscal situation, and that's an issue that I think this committee ought to continue to discuss. So, thank you.
Vice Chair Scott, Representative Williams, one thing that I would like to say is that I think it's important to view this fund as a permanent fund and in a very long-term way for the kids of this state. We will see fluctuations over time with the Common School Fund. Over the long run, we hope, from what we've heard from Frank Russell and company, that we should be earning, over the long run, about 7% per year. If we use that 7% and we consider revenues that are flowing into the Common School Fund, within 10 years, we're going to have more than a doubling of this fund. So we'll be upwards of over $1.2 billion. And then knowing the power of compounding, that will also happen again. So within just a couple short generations, what I hope to see the Common School Fund is being, you know, a real contributor to the schools and to be one of the pieces in trying to find a long-term funding solution for the schools. Now, granted, this is not going to cover all the needs of the school, and it really is probably a couple drops in the bucket for the schools. But I sit on my daughter's site council, and I see that even small amounts can make a big difference. And if the Common School Fund can do that over time, I think it's a wise investment for our kids.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd just simply say that while I don't disagree at all with you, Director, about the long-term nature of this issue, and I think certainly those portions which are the constitutional lands and some of those things that were set up in its original designation ought to be used exactly as you described. I also would say that I think the commitment to intergenerational equity, as you pointed out, doesn't necessarily mean that we only focus on two generations out as we address this problem. The requirement of intergenerational equity also requires that we do this from addressing the current generation's needs in their educational environment. And that's where perhaps you and I might have a slight disagreement about how we view that concept of intergenerational equity.
And I think that is the real tricky thing when it comes to the Common School Fund, is trying to weigh out, you know, what benefiting kids today versus kids of the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you for your excellent presentation. And I don't mean to put you on the spot with this, but there have been some proposals about selling Elliott State Forest and maybe turning it into a more liquid, a more manageable asset within the Common School Fund. And I was just wondering if you have an opinion on some of the trade-offs you'd be looking at if you did that.
Mm-hmm. I know that there's been a proposal out there, Vice Chair Scott, Representative Haas, on doing that. If you would sell the Elliott State Forest, then the proceeds of that Elliott State Forest would go into the Common School Fund. They would not be available for distribution to address any kind of other problem or even to send out today for the schools, because it is part of that constitutional land base. I think at the time when the stock market was riding high, it looked like our returns on the forest were fairly low. But if you try to look at the Common School Fund and its assets from a portfolio standpoint, I view the Elliott State Forest as an important part of the real estate portfolio of the Common School Fund. So now when it's yielding about 3-4% for the fund, that looks actually fairly good compared to what we're dealing with on the equity side of it. So it's nice to have some of that rounding out of our overall portfolio.
Thank you. If I could,
yes.
That's good to know. I just didn't know if because of forest fire liabilities and the price of timber falling, that if it was more of a headache than anything else, and I didn't know. But you're saying that it's profitable and not that much of a headache.
Vice Chair Scott, Representative Haas, yes, it is profitable, and I believe that it has an important place in the Common School Fund over the long term.
Thank you.
Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When was the last time before the peak that the Common School Fund was worth about what it was worth, what it's worth now? Do you know?
Vice Chair Scott, Representative Barnhart, the highest it ever was at $800 million. It went from a low, at the beginning of the 90s, it was around, I think, around $150 to $200 million. So it did nearly quadruple to its peak of $800 million.
Mr. Chair, the question, what I'm asking is, can you give us approximate date before the peak when it was worth approximately what it's worth now?
Oh, Vice Chair Scott, Representative Barnett, we would have to get that information for you. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, would it have been a couple of years before? Or?
Let me see if looking at this one chart.
Look at that chart.
That's not that
Yeah. Probably goes back to 97, is what I've just been informed.
Okay, and if I may,
go ahead.
Just follow this thought up a little bit. From the period of 1997 until today, there have been substantial distributions from the Common School Fund for the benefit of the schools. Doing the arithmetic quickly in my head, it's somewhere between $150 and $200 million during that period mm-hmm. of time. And yet the fund is worth today what it was worth only 6 years ago. Again, if I could follow through on the thought a little bit. And it's worth four times what it was at the beginning of a decade ago. I guess my comment is that your strategy of growing the fund over time, making it useful for the current generation and also available for the future generation, looks a lot better when you think about the development for the last decade than it does if we only look at the period from the top of the market to today.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think it is important to take that long-term view, because when we're investing for the fund, we're at a 68% equity, and that is one, actually, our portfolio mix is one thing that we're considering of whether we stay at that 68%. But it was done for trying to have an aggressive investment strategy so that we look at that long-term view of the investment of the fund.
Thank you.
Additional questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Informative presentation.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll open the public hearing on 2180. Go ahead.
Again, for the record, I'm Ann Hannes, Director of the Division of State Lands, and I apologize that we weren't aware of the change in the chairs that is for today. So, Vice Chair Scott, we'd like to talk, and members of the committee would like to talk about what this bill is intended in the background and the reasons for it. There are two things that House Bill 2180 does. It allows the land board to establish a reserve account within the distributable income account. This would allow us to capture earnings during good times to be used in later distributions during market downturns. And then money in this account would be used to stabilize those distributions over time so we'd level some of those large swings that we've seen in recent years. The second thing that it does is it eliminates the requirement that any losses resulting from equities be deducted from the earnings prior to distribution. So right now, I think that deducting any losses from that earnings flow out to schools was done as a way to be an incentive for or thinking twice about the type of investments you do. But under current modern portfolio management, sometimes you need to, sell a dog in order to reposition that portfolio to be better off in the future. And so this would enable us to be able to do that repositioning without adversely affecting the kids of today, because over the long term it would be benefiting the kids of the future. The legislation that you have before you was proposed as an idea, and I have to say right up front that we're trying to look at several different ideas to try to increase and stabilize distributions over time. And it came out of some of the discussions that occurred during last year's special sessions. As we've talked about, we've had a high of about $40.8 million in 2001 to a low of $9.3 million in 1995. And overall, what we're trying to do is to stabilize and increase common school fund distributions over time while still providing for the long growth fund. And we want to be able to make sound strategic portfolio changes that will benefit the fund over time. We talked about some of the trust responsibilities of weighing out today and future generations of kids. But one of the things that the Attorney General said in their advice was that we couldn't withdraw earnings after the biennium in which they were earned. So we couldn't withdraw those because that was not legal. It could only be done within the period it was earned. It's similar to when you're filing your tax returns, for example, and you have capital gains. You only file it within that period, and then you have to keep dealing with it in future. It becomes part of your overall savings. Now, we've explored several different options that would help stabilize the distributions, and one of those options is before you, this deferred distribution account. We're looking at another option that would revise our asset portfolio mix. So, for example, instead of a 68% equities, we might go to a 50% equities. That would mean that we'd have a more predictable flow of earnings that we'd send out to schools. But each of these different approaches has its pros and cons. For example, although the reserve account could smooth out distributions, one of the things that we would propose if we wanted to still pursue that option would be to put some amendments for this bill, to put some more sideboards on it so that account could only be used for distributions to schools during market downturns or, for example, when we are only able to make our minimum distribution. And then on the other hand, if we would change our portfolio mix, it would generate more predictable earnings. But as you know, with trade-offs between risk and long-term return, although it hasn't held true in the last several years, but usually you'll have a greater return the more risk you take over time. So we would likely have a little bit lower return for the fund over time. We would ask you, because we are currently weighing these different options and the land board's trying to consider which one would have the most merits, we'd ask you that for the time being that you hold off on any action on this bill until we can come back and provide you with a recommendation that would be most beneficial to school distributions. And we hope that we'd be able to let you know within the next 1 to 2 months. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and
we certainly would agree with Director Hannes' suggestion on holding off on this bill. We had a chance to take a look at it and agree that the portion of the bill dealing with portfolio management is a reasonable approach to allow sale of the director's dogs on this thing. But what we are not supporting and have been talking with the director about is establishment of an account that exposes portions of the funds available for distribution from the Common School Fund over a period of time, setting up this essentially an equalization or a stabilization fund. Our belief is that at this point, to expose those funds would be to have them used for purposes other than distribution to the schools, and that's been our experience during the past five special sessions. We would not want those funds exposed for purposes other than distribution to the schools. And checking with school superintendents around the state, we found that most superintendents were not disappointed when they received their portion of the $41 million and understood when they received only their portion of the $10 million, but they would hate to miss the opportunity to manage their own funds. We will continue to talk with the department regarding this, but at this point, we don't see any need for this portion of the legislation.
Okay. Questions?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone else on 2180? If not, I'll close the public hearing. There will be, additional information coming forward on that, so we will move in that direction. We have some work session issues and introductions of bills this morning. I believe that you have two of them. LC 1449, we would like to have as a committee bill. Moving it for that. Relating to the assignments and portions of the funds. Paul?
Yes, Mr. Chair, LC 1449 was referred to by Treasury. They have been working on preparing the securitization of establishing the Master Settlement Asset Corporation, and this particular concept would help clarify that securitization process. So that's the intent of it, and it's recommended that it be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I would move that we introduce LC 1449 as a committee bill.
It's moved that by Representative Williams that 1449 be moved as a committee bill without objections. We'll so do. Okay. We'll move 1449 as a committee bill. 2090. Paul? Do we need? No, we don't need that.
Paul.
Okay, Claire, the bill is entered as a committee bill but does not indicate support or opposition by the members of the committee. Okay.
It's a fine print disclaimer.
Fine print disclaimer. All the legal things.
Next, Mr. Chair, you have LC 2090, which comes to you from the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association. And what it does is extend a period which cargo containers are exempt from property tax. So that is at the request of that association.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I move that LC 2090 be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay.
At the request of the
Columbia River
Steamship Operators.
Okay. It's been moved that LC 2090 be moved as a committee bill at the request of the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association. Any objections? Hearing none, we'll move it forward as a committee bill. Anything else?
I think that's it, Mr. Chair.
Jerry, you need to read your disclaimer again. You're getting your eye over there from the committee assistant.
I thought I did that. LC 2090 moved forward as a committee bill at the request of the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association.
But does not
indicate support or opposition by the members of the committee. Have I successfully stumbled my way through this?
You're there.
Okay. Anything else come before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I'll just remind the committee that there is no meeting scheduled tomorrow. And on Friday, Chair Shetterly will be back, and we have a meeting scheduled around 9 o'clock after the 8:34 session, in which we'll have the second part of your major issue on economic development policy and revenue policy, this time from a labor perspective. So you have a panel of those in the labor, representing the labor sector to talk with you.
Great. Okay. Revenue committee meeting, stand up.
Very well.
Sorry.